Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point, was in Iowa earlier this month, in Ames. And this hour, we listen to excerpts from a conversation that my colleague Clay Masters had with Ashbrook before a live audience on the campus of Iowa State University. Clay Masters started by asking about Ashbrook's childhood and says he grew up on a farm in central Illinois.
So tell us a little bit about when you moved away from Illinois. What took you out east?
Oh, well, I grew up like I suppose kids still do here with everything you do on the farm, you know, with baling hay and walking. In those days before Roundup, walking the soybeans and... before Roundup, but I get it. But you also know there's a lot of hard work in the sun, right? That was a lot, and 4-H and Farm Bureau and church and working with all the farmers in the neighborhood, and I absolutely loved that. It was a really great childhood. But I want to see the world like a lot of people do. I understand some kids from Iowa actually go out also, and maybe too many. I'm sorry about that, but. I was one of those from Illinois, and in high school, I kind of want to go out to the East Coast and see what's going on out there. And so they said, great, you know, and we worked on setting up some time out there, and then how were they going to get me out there? Because, you know, it's like, it's a long way out, and, you know, crop prices some years are great and some years they aren't. And so my mom had a friend in... Peoria, who worked at the stockyards in Peoria. And I packed my bag and we drove over to Peoria. And I remember they had a kind of a short version of a control tower like at the airport, but just in this huge lot full of semi-trailer trucks being filled with livestock. And we walked down this long row of semis and he's looking at, checking off on his clipboard, who's going where. He says, oh, maybe here. There's a semi full of hogs going to the slaughterhouse in Philadelphia. He said, is this good? And he said, yeah, that's fine. So they put me up in the cab of that truck going to Philly. And that was my solo journey to the East Coast. And and I tell you what, I learned some things on that trip that I didn't know. When I try to describe my childhood to people on the East Coast, I've tried so many ways to convey what it was like. It was so simple and so compared to, you know, New York City. So I just say it was kind of Amish, which is, you know, I mean, it was sort of Amish with tractors. And it's a little exaggeration, but from where they're coming, it's not really an exaggeration. It really isn't. So I learned, you know, like, for one thing, you didn't swear. No, you know, if you said, gosh darn, that was already like GD. That was like too close to the line, right? And on those truckers, this was the CB radio. Remember, oh my gosh, I heard some language on that trip. I learned about how truckers stay up for so many hours, you know, white lines and all that. And I also learned, though I'd been around a lot of livestock, I learned what a semi full of hogs smells like after 3 days in the sun going to Philly. And when I got off of that truck, I dragged my suitcase across to the bus station and ended up, I said, I'm out here, I should apply to these fancy schools that are out here because they're so famous. You know, I heard of Harvard and Yale, so I thought, I'll just go and say hi. And so I did, and I just showed up and I said, hi, I'm here for an interview. And who are you? Well, I'm Tom, I'm from Illinois. They're like, oh, yeah. And anyway, then I would have it, and they said, okay. And then I'd say, well, could you put me up tonight anywhere? Because, I got nowhere to stay. And they put me up. But I ended up getting into Yale, and I have always thought, everybody has some, like, special card in their deck, and I've always thought that my affirmative action card was that incredibly pungent smell in all my clothes of a truck full of hogs. That was my ace in the hole. Anyway, I don't know.
So we're all familiar with your radio show with On Point. But there was a long career in journalism leading up to that point. So we've gotten off the hog truck. We're in Yale. Tell us about what happened after that.
It was a big culture shock going from almost Amish to Yale. And in very exciting in many ways, I made lifelong friends there who are still my best buddies. But after a couple of years, the almost Amish part of me was like, I don't know, this whole urban, dense. And there was one class that I really loved, and it was at the Yale Divinity School. And it was in Vedantic mysticism, which may sound weird. But the Vedas, you know, are the pre-Hindu texts of South Asia, religious texts. And I loved reading these things, and I was trying to figure out why. And in those texts, there's a god for everything. There's a god of fire. There's a god of the dawn. There's a god of everything. And I realized, you know, when you grow up in a church in the Midwest, every Sunday singing, you know, in rustling grass, I hear him pass, he's with me everywhere. It's kind of the same idea, that there's divinity in everything. That sort of sense of the divine and everything was kind of what I was missing. And I said to one of my classmates who was in the divinity school, I said, I don't know if this place is right for me. I might drop out. I can imagine my parents fainting dead away, you know, but you get into Yale and you dropped out? He said, no, if you like this, don't drop out, go to India. So I did the junior year in India. And then that was the first of 10 years in Asia. During that, early in that time, I started to work for the South China Morning Post, the main English language newspaper in Hong Kong, which was a great way to begin because it was China was just opening up. The boat people were coming up from Vietnam in those years. It was super exciting. And there was a lot of other crazy stuff that went on. I got roped into doing some television in Hong Kong. I produced kung fu films while I was in Hong Kong, which was totally fabulous. In the old studios where Bruce Lee got his start there, and it was just great. And then went to work for the Boston Globe as their bureau chief in Asia and had many years of covering all of Asia before I came back to the Globe. Covered the end of the Cold War, the first Gulf War. Then on September 11th, 2001, my partner and I had left the first company and we were ready to start another company. And we were headed to Lower Manhattan to talk with venture capital friends about doing that. And we had a first meeting in Connecticut on the way. We were driving down to Manhattan because we had this meeting in Westport, Connecticut, with one of the investors in our first company who wanted to talk to us. And as we were pulling in the parking lot, my wife called and she said, turn the radio on, there's something happening in New York, I can't figure out what. And we turned it on and it was these, you remember, it was, they were just sketchy, what, an airplane, what? And so we walked in, and there was nobody at the front desk, and hello, hello, we went back, and they're all in the boardroom, everybody in the firm looking out over the beautiful Tidal Flats, and they had a TV on, and we walked in just as the second little flash of silver came in, into the second tower. And then everyone's just staring, and we don't know what's happening, and then, whoosh, you know, we all watched dumbfounded. And it's so weird, we're all in shock. We actually went ahead and had a meeting, but none of us can remember a single word of that meeting. We were just like zombies in that first couple hours. What? But obviously we did not drive on to Lower Manhattan that day. And two or three days later, I got a call from WBUR, which is a very big public radio station in Boston. And they said, NPR just called us, and all of their people, literally all, have been working around the clock for 72 hours, and they need fresh horses, they said. Could you come in and talk to us about helping out? So I went in, and they're all around a big table, and they had on a whiteboard, they'd sketched out a show, and they said, you know, we know you're a well-known journalist, and you haven't been doing journalism for a while, but we're kind of in a crunch here. Would you be willing to go on the air starting 3 hours a night, starting tomorrow night on 500 stations for emergency coverage?
Why not?
Yeah. But I was a huge public radio fan. I had listened to the shows out of this station for years very avidly. I had filled in for a couple hours over that previous summer when a host had left the station. And it was an emergency. You don't say no, right? No, I'm busy, you know. No, so and it was terrifying because I was sort of 0 to 60. But within a few weeks, I loved it. And we just didn't stop. When the emergency was over, they said, would you keep going? And that was turned into On Point, and now it's 16 years later, and I have fallen so deeply in love with the medium of radio, and unlike physical newspaper, audio is never going to go away as something that human beings love, and it's very effective for getting straight into the brain without all the goofy razzmatazz, and I love it. So I'm Tom, and I'm addicted to radio.
On this edition of River to River, you're listening to a recorded conversation taped earlier this month between my colleague Clay Masters and Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point.
One of the common questions that often comes to people that work in public radio is how much time does it take to put into a show like On Point? It sounds very smooth, but there are a lot of gears cranking around. How much time, say, would you goes into one show?
Wow. Sarah and Hillary, my producers in the audience, could tell you, along with the rest of the team. It's a big team. It's a staff of like 10 that puts On Point together. And it's person hours, I guess you'd have to think of, because there's so many hours of first, every day right after the show, we're thinking about the shows we're doing the next day. Even before each morning show, we're updating what we're going to do the next day. While I'm on the air, that team of producers, and this is why, you know, you turn into a lot of commercial radio, and what is it? It's just one angry dude, usually, sort of shaking a newspaper and pounding on the table and spouting. But in our case, I've got these great producers who, while I'm on the air, they're just plowing into the internet to do great background research on whatever we've decided we're going to do the next day. So they're doing hours of research right there, and they've started already, if they haven't, booking guests all over the country, all over the world, setting up studios for them to be in, pulling sound because we'd like a sound-rich show to bring it to life. When the show's over, we sit down and we've got an hour-long then meeting with the whole staff about what we're doing tomorrow and then days after that, and who do we have booked for the next day, and are they the right people, and could we do, you know, do we have our ideal guests? Do we want to shift the way we're thinking about it? That's a very intense conversation. I walk out of there early afternoon with two big stacks of background material, one on each hour for the next day, plus very often a honking big book or, you know, on top of that. And then I go off to the gym and to do errands and whatever. And then every night, and this is the hard part, it's the discipline part, but it's what allows the show to be worthy of an NPR audience, which is a very good, smart, attentive audience. I actually do the work. I immerse myself in all the research that my producers have done so that when I come to the show the next morning, I am well-versed in it. And then, if you've ever seen any video of the show, on top of that, I mark up all this stuff. So there's a huge table in the studio that's just covered in yellow highlighted papers with facts and numbers and names and, you know, treaties and all that stuff. So that during the show, when things come up, it may sound like I know everything. I'm actually referring to the work that my producers have done and I've absorbed and marked up. And I've got all the sound they put together. I've got the great guests they put together. So how many person hours go into a show? Maybe 10 to 1 if you put in all the engineer, the producer, the executive producer, the pulling the sound with, and I don't know. For me, it's several hours, and it's way beyond me, though. So it is a lot. But for a show like this, to be worthy of an audience like this nationally and globally, we have listeners everywhere, to do it the way we want to do it with respect for our audience, that's just what it takes.
And give us an example of when you finished a show and just felt like you really connected with what you were trying to do. Do you have an example?
Oh,
do you have kind of a feeling that you have afterwards?
Oh yeah. The ones that are great are when I feel like we really get to the heart of the issue. We cut through the sort of BS and the claptrap and the positioning and the posing, and we get down to what the core issues are. And you can tell we're hitting it because the calls always come in so abundantly. And Iowa, check it yourself before you wreck yourself. You got so many callers here, you know, it's amazing.
Sometimes we carry it live.
So yeah. But it's like, wow, enough with the Iowa callers for a while, you know. Give the rest of the country a chance. But you can hear in the way they're responding when they're like connecting with the heart of it and the questions get better. And when we have guests who are really good at going straight to it and in a vivid way conveying what's going on and who don't ramble on and on. You know, at On Point we always think about, because this is 2017, people have a lot of options. You know, and there's a million podcasts, one button away. We always think about value per minute. Like, I feel like every 60 seconds I should be bringing you something valuable. It's just been high value throughout. It hasn't been a prisoner of cliche or stereotype. We break through to what's really important about it, and we hear that connect with the listeners, then we all feel really great after the show. And that happens very often. Yeah.
So in the current journalism market today, you talk about cutting through the BS and the claptrap. How do you do that?
Oh. First of all, by wanting to. Because there are a lot of people in the media now who make a very good living by riding some particular pony to death, some ideological horse, where they care more about the ideology than the facts of the matter. You've heard NPR talking lately, their latest slogan, and I really like it, is because it's about themselves, but it's also an appeal to their audience and to the citizens of this country: stand with the facts. And first of all, it's just the desire and goal and determination to do that. I'm not trying to prove any particular point. I'm not trying to justify any preconceived ideology. I'm trying, along with my expert guests and along with my listeners and callers, to get to what's really and truly going on. And that in itself has become too rare in this sort of polarized, politicized time of media. So that's number one. Number two is do the research, do the background work, and do the homework. Know what you're talking about, because otherwise you're just going to be punditry, surfing on waves of other people's opinion. What is that? A lot of that is just froth. Another thing that's so important is really listening to the people who have done the work to understand it deeply, really listening to the questions that listeners have, not in a knee-jerk way like, oh, you're a conservative, get off, or get out, or oh, you're a liberal, you're full of it, but really listen to what they have to. Our listeners add incredible value to the show with their personal experience. You do a show on healthcare, and the callers come in talking about their experience, and it just can blow your mind how difficult it can be, or, you know, in some cases, what's working, what's not. But listen, really listen to the heart of people's concern or worry or joy in a particular issue. Real listening has become rare, because people just push on toward a preconceived conclusion. If you do those things, you've got a pretty good start on cutting through the bull.
And over the last 16 years since you started hosting On Point, have you noticed a change? I mean, like, obviously we have noticed a change in journalism and the way that people take in media, but when did you start to realize that things were really changing from the journalism industry that you got into when you started?
Well, I mean, I remember, and my dad here in the audience will remember this, you know, when I was a kid, and this is when they still had the so-called fairness doctrine, where if you had one opinion on the air, you had to give the chance to somebody who thought the other way. And you still had overwhelmingly local ownership of newspapers and radio. So let's think about radio. In my hometown, there was a terrific, very robust local radio station, locally owned by a family that had, you know, been in the part of the community forever. They had great, smart, insightful local news anchors there. And they had lots of voices from the community who would be pro and con on a given issue, and you would know these. And so, first of all, that was news that was very connected to the community. So it couldn't just be up at some 30,000-foot ideological level, or people would say, what are you talking about? It was all tied into real life. So it had to have the complexity and the humanity of real life. Now, so many stations are just owned by national chains, and the word on how they're going to present the news comes down from, you know, some skyscraper in New York or wherever. And that local connection, the community involvement, is much less real. One thing that's been a saving grace of public radio is that because of its history, it is bolted into all these local stations around the country that were stitched together back in the 70s, basically, to form the NPR network. And sometimes it's a total pain, I know, for the management, because it's like herding cats to make things happen. But it also means these are locally supported stations with local people who know their local communities working in them. That's a fantastic base. That's great. But nationally and commercially, that became the minority. And then you got highly polarized news, because there's news. There's no more fairness doctrine, so that allows Fox News and all these other things, which when they first came up, to me, they were like, what is this? This isn't news as I understand it. I mean, you can hear their agenda so intensely in their presentation. And people may like it, they may go for it, it may be what they want to hear, and you can make the argument, and I'm willing to hear it, that in the settled news media before, there may have been certain attitudes that were embedded as well, but this was just more deliberate and more overt. And that was, of course, growing and growing since while I've been with NPR. And then we come to Mr. Trump, who has this fake news mantra. I don't know how many of you have gone to Trump rallies or went during the campaign or even since he's become president. But this is a then candidate and now head of state of our nation who absolutely savages the media. I mean, savages it in these big arenas full of people just roaring where, to me, it's a shocking thing because the First Amendment is in our Constitution for a reason. The founders of our nation, who were no idiots, understood that we need a critical press watching everything. And it's one thing to be disgruntled or unhappy. I suppose all presidents have their criticisms. But to just savage the press again and again in a way that is clearly, deliberately intended to remove all confidence in our press, our free press, that's something brand new. And to have that in the president with that kind of savagery astounds me. And it hacks at the roots of something that's very important to our democracy. And so it worries me. He's got his complaints. You know, I'm a journalist. I'll listen to them. But at an hominem attack on the press at large and this planting so deeply the idea of fake news so that people are already confused about what's real. You have so much stuff out there in the digital world now. It's very easy to be confused. You've got deliberate manipulation of it, both from inside and now outside our country. And to that broad brush painting of news gathering organizations as fake news, I find very disconcerting. And that is about a year and a half old. That is of the Trump era, and that's where we are now. So when you support real news, you're doing something very important right now, and I appreciate it.
In just a moment, we'll hear more of the conversation Clay Masters had with Tom Ashbrook earlier this month, November 9th, before a live audience at the Iowa State University Alumni Center. And when we come back, Ashbrook talks about being a good listener in this day and age and shares some of his experiences being a reporter overseas. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now back to a conversation that my colleague Clay Masters had with Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. It was recorded on the campus of Iowa State University on November 9th. Masters at this point asked him what he takes away from his early years in journalism that he uses now to be a good journalist and broadcaster.
Well, from the overseas part, that's easy because, first of all, just to live abroad for an extended period of time, it teaches you a lot about the complexity of this planet and how we have a way, but it's not the way. There's all kinds of ways. And we have a culture, but it's not the culture. Though our culture is mighty and spreads far. But it teaches you to listen in a different way. And then to have spent all that time in Asia, especially because in the years since, the places that I spent so much time, China, Japan, India, they've just risen and risen. And so, for example, when President Trump is in China, I know China so intimately, and Japan, and Korea. When Secretary Tillerson is in India, I've spent a lot of time. These are real places to me. I understand the culture, and it gives you a lot of confidence that you're not just spouting to have a ground level sense. Maybe even more importantly, in terms of journalism, to have come up in old school newspaper reporting, where there were editors who had serious expectations about you nailing the facts in every single story you wrote. And they expected you to have it, you know, not just sort of speculate, not throw some stuff in there. And if you didn't have it, you heard about it, you know. You had to, I'll tell you a story. This was at the South China Morning Post, my very first job. I was a cub reporter. And this is the kind of newspaper where you did not just one story a day. They might have you doing two or three stories a day running around town. And I'd gone to cover some speech, and I raced back. And I put the, this is in the early days of computers with newspapers. And we would all rush to get it in, because at a certain time, it was like 5 o'clock, the classified ad department would dump all the ads in. And that would overwhelm the computer. So before, just before they dumped it in, there were red lights and a siren that would go off, and which meant, reporters, save your stories. Because if you don't, they're going to get lost in this tidal wave of ads coming in, right? So I was racing along, and I was about to put the guy's title in for the speech, and I couldn't find it, but I wanted to put it in later, so to save the space, I put his name, and comma, for his title, I just typed in, fully intending to put the real title in later, I put just in Bebop of Bebops as his title, right? And then I go off, in those days, old-fashioned reporters, the guys who knew their stuff, they'd all finished their stories already, because they were so fast. I was new and I was laboring. They would all go down to the corner place and have a beer before they came back to write their dramatic finish, right? And so we go down, and I go back up, you know, to get the title and pull it in, and there is a note on my desk, and it's from the editor-in-chief of the South China Morning Post, and it says, Mr. Ashbrook, I do not consider it humorous that you have included the title Bebop of Bebop in your story about Mr. Hootenanny, whatever his name was. Do not do this again. And so, you know, it was that kind of education in old school serious reporting meant get the facts, nail them, and have that in your work. And that still informs me today. And I'm always, of course, when you, as you become more than a cub reporter, they want the facts and they want incisive interpretation. But base it in facts, and that's still at the heart of my work today. And that's an inheritance from that realm that I'm very grateful for.
And there are some journalism students in the audience tonight.
Awesome. You go, journalism students.
So their old school is going to be quite different than your old school.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So now we're going to talk about the future again a little bit. What advice do you give to aspiring journalists that live in a very different media landscape, and the future of journalism is regularly questioned?
First of all, may the Lord bless you and keep you. Second, and most importantly, thank God you're studying journalism. We really need you, and we always will. I mean, we need you as a democracy, as a society, as a culture. We have to know what's going on. And people who are committed to observing and reporting factually what's happening are essential. And now we live in this welter of just stuff. Some of it's true and some of it's false, and a whole lot of it is just opinion. So first of all, I'm very glad that you're studying journalism, and study well. And, you know, old school is not the only way, but always remember the importance of getting the facts right. If you want to be in journalism, please, and I know you will. The second thing I would say is, I hope you will resist the urge to go straight from journalism school to punditry. Because I know there's a big market for punditry now, and maybe you'll end up doing some punditry, but earn it. Put in your time doing real reporting. Don't make that your first goal. It's not worthy. If you don't have the legs under it, it's really nothing. And it's kind of worse than nothing. You know, because it's just spinning stuff out of thin air. And there's enough gas in the atmosphere already. We don't need more. So go out and do the noble, real work of reporting. And we need to know what's going on. We need to know what's going on in our environment, we need to know what's going on in our government, we need to know what's going on in our economy, we need to go, all of it. how are you going to find a job? I know it's a big question. I'll tell you, first of all, it's not like this show is folded, you know. NPR's out there. There are papers out there. There's real news being done right now, and there are jobs, and there's need for fresh people coming in. So I know what the sort of cliche is, you know, it's, oh my God, it's ending. Well, it's not. It's still going on. So go out and take those jobs. And there's lots of new venues that are opening up. Now, the business models have been tricky, but a bunch of those are starting to really have legs as well. You know, things start online, Politico, and pretty soon it's really powerful. Don't despair. There's real work out there to be done. It's to be done at the local level and to be done, you know, state and regional and national and global. Go get it. It's out there. It ain't over, and we need you. And as you do it, always be thinking about ways to bring old school values, and I mean that in the most admiring way, and a flexible way, but with commitment to factuality, into this new realm, because we need people who are committed to doing that, not just maximizing profit by putting a barbecue grill in front of you if that's what I think you want to buy. You know, Facebook and Google and all that, okay, but their commitment, number one, is to making a ton of money. And we need people who are committed, number one, to having an informed society that can be an effective democracy. Because a society that is ignorant or misled cannot be a healthy democracy over time. So, hey, reshape it any way you want. I'm with you. I'm game. But keep that as your guiding light.
Some of the best advice... Yeah. Some of the best advice that I had received from my first professional mentor in public broadcasting was that paying attention is important, and really listening, not having a preconceived notion going in, but just paying attention. How do you pay attention in your show and to what is going on around when there is so much noise?
Oh. I mean, on the show, one of the things that drew me and continues to draw me to live radio is, and you know this feeling, Clay, and I know from just this interview how well you must do this. When the red light goes on in the studio and everybody's listening, you better be on. And there's a kind of an adrenaline rush that comes from that, which is sort of like nothing else I've ever done. When you feel a whole country listening, you better be paying attention, because they're all paying attention. You know, they at the end of those 2 hours every day, often it's kind of like, oh, I feel like I've been playing basketball, you know, for a couple of hours. You get so much deeper. If you're not listening, you know you're not harvesting the real value. We get callers, some of whom are just geniuses, and I think, wow, who are you? And how do you know how to express yourself that amazingly? You know, we were talking about with Ron Chernow about his new book on Ulysses S. Grant. Amazing book. But we had callers who were amazing. There's a guy named Lafayette who called in from Baltimore, and Chernow loved that because Lafayette, you know, and he did the book on Washington, and so there's this African-American clearly calling in, and his name is Lafayette. And his dissection of our American moment was so genius. I thought, Mike, who is this man who's sitting somewhere? He was an older gentleman. Who knows what his life has been like as an African American? If he's 80 years old now, he's been, you know, I'm sure it hasn't been easy, but he's just a genius. And I just let him roll, and it was brilliant analysis. Other times, you come talk about listening, you have listeners who, what? You know, like, I'm listening, and look, it's public radio, it's theirs. So I respect them, and they've taken the time to call in. And I know they've got something. But some, you know, like, it's just a fact. Some people, it's harder to get it out. So I'm listening really carefully, because I want to help them get that thing out that they called about. And if I can be helpful in, like, saying, is that? Oh, that. It's an inducement to listen carefully to figure out what the hell they have to... But it's usually there, and it's usually worth grabbing, but it's also an incentive to really listen.
And you can use that Midwest nice to tell them you're done.
Well, that's funny, because You know, one of the things when I went to the East Coast is I was like, oh my God, people are not so nice. But so people are like, how are you so nice? And it's actually not, I mean, I don't know how it sounds to you. To me, it's
not
just,
nice.
It's just it's just regular. Oh. It's, you know, you say thank you and you, I don't know, you're just respectful to people and you have good manners and I just try and do that. But we've got listeners like in New York who are like, how in the hell do you do that? Like it's some, you know, amazing thing. And it's just, yes, Midwest nice. And it's just the way I was raised, I guess.
On this edition of River to River, you're listening to a recorded conversation taped earlier this month between my colleague Clay Masters and Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point.
Is there anything that's surprising about in all these years that you've been hosting this show that has caught you off guard, or anything that you just never anticipated, even after years of hosting On Point?
Oh, there have been some surprising moments. You know, sometimes things will start late and sometimes they'll end early. We had Spike Lee booked and I was really excited. And, you know, you sort of learn as you go. When you have a one person, you know, one guest for the whole hour, Spike, and then that's all you have planned for the show, you know. And like, I'm reading the intro and, you know, I only have only a minute and a half in the whole hour that's scripted. And I'm reading it and they're like, in my ear, Eileen, who's my regular director, Sarah will be my director here tomorrow, but I'm reading and she's singing in my ear. You learn in radio how to talk and listen at the same time. She's saying, Spike's not in the studio. So, okay, I'm gonna represent for like the angriest black man in America. So Spike is like not there, but okay, now I'm done. So I'm like dancing, I'm talking, and I'm ad-libbing about his latest movie or whatever it was, and how we've got sound clips, and like, let's listen to a little bit from this movie. And I'm looking, okay, this clip is 29 seconds long. Please, Spike, show up in this 20. It was 20 minutes before Spike showed up. And I mean, I riffed more on, you know, like hip hop and race relations and the state of modern cinema, taking callers. What do you think about Spike Lee? You know, I mean, Spike just stretched me. There was a great conversation with Peter Drucker. Now, Peter Drucker was this super genius interpreter of the American economy and capitalism. And it was one of the most moving interviews. He was in Albuquerque, I think, at the time. He was very retired, though he worked forever. And I didn't know this because as we went along, it only emerged at the very end that the guy I was going to interview, Peter Drucker, who's a brilliant, you know, legend, was stone cold deaf. But he had his assistant who would listen and write it down, and I thought, this is never going to work, you know. But then when he came on, he was so completely present. He was like 98 years old, and he was so vividly alive, and his intelligence is so completely on that it blew away most, you know, any guest I could think of who was 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. I mean, and you're just like, wow, this is amazing. The human mind is capable of amazing things. And the fact that he couldn't hear my voice didn't matter. I could tell that as she scratched it down, he could hear the music even in my voice. He was even responding to the inside music of the question. That was fantastic. And then at the end, remember Art Buchwald, the humorist? He wrote these humor columns forever. If you're young, you may not remember him, but he was a big, big, famous humorist in the Washington Post and syndicated everywhere. And he had this famous thing where the doctor told him he was going to die. And so he went into hospice and prepared to die. And then, this is great, this is pure gold for a humorist, he didn't die. So he comes back out of hospice, and of course he writes a book about it right away. Because it's like Mark Twain's dream, you know. And we put him on the show right away. So it's like, oh, this is amazing. Because he was still really funny. And we're talking about all how close he was to death. And we get about 8 minutes from the end of the show. And he's kind of tapering off. And I'm like, And then I ask a question. And it's just silence. Art? And I'm thinking of the headlines, you know. American humorist Art Buchwald dies on NPR while being interviewed on NPR's On Point. I really thought, oh my God, you know, he didn't have time to get back to the hospice, and he just died. Oh my God. He had just kind of nodded off.
Just a power nap.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Those are some memorable moments. There are lots of others. Live radio is an amazing and beautiful thing.
After 16 years, are there places you feel that On Point can still go? Do you feel, how do you push yourself to change and adapt and bring new ideas and just strategies for hosting the show?
Well, that's a great question.
Into the future.
Yeah, into the future. One thing that's happened, and everybody knows about this, is that now everything is podcast. So that's just really interesting, because we always have kept track of where we're broadcast, and that's a big deal. With podcast, you get picked up everywhere. And that has really changed our sense. You always had people with weird radio connections who would be like, we've had people call in from Saudi Arabia or from a yacht in the South Pacific. I don't know how they did that, but somehow they wangled up an antenna. But now people listen really everywhere. And so that, we get letters. I got a letter from a guy the other day. He said, I'm a Kenyan working in Dubai, and I love your show. And it's like, wow. Or, just everywhere. One time we looked back in the course of a month at our website, and we'd had visitors from something like 153 countries out of 180 countries in the world. So that's just fascinating to contemplate. To stay fresh, part of the way is, and I love this, that we always have a lot of young staff on the show, and their perspective, it keeps you on your toes, and they may look at things in a different way. And at first I may be like, what are you talking about? But then when you listen, it's like, oh, that's what you're talking about. Okay, and so that's great. And it's why everybody needs to be refreshing from the young side all the time. There are things that happily don't change. I said at the beginning, but I really believe people love audio. They love stories. They love storytelling. They love gathering around a conversation. That feeling you get where you're at a campfire or by a fireplace at night and somebody's talking, and it's mesmerizing. So if you have good guests who have wonderful things to deliver, I don't think that will ever go away. And the beautiful thing about it is, newspapers were heavy and dirty. You had to put them in recycling. They got ink on your fingers. This thing, you just put it in your earbuds or whatever and go anywhere, do anything. Is the most portable, wherever you are, kind of medium there is. And so I think we just follow it where it goes. In whatever setting it is, we'll be there. Who said that? Like Shoeless, who was that? When you're almost asleep at night, we'll be there. When you get up in the morning and brushing your teeth, we'll be there. But radio, audio, because it's not just going to be broadcast, as we know, it will be there. And whatever form that takes, I'm down with it.
And what does your news diet look like? What's your food pyramid of media consumption look like? How do you get exactly.
There's the sort of, I try and just get as much of the main things as I can in there. The big papers, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. We try and keep track of the big regional papers as well, out of Chicago and LA. We have all the magazines come in and we try and scan them to see what's going on. There's a way in which, for me, Twitter has become a really interesting media radar, because if you follow good people, they're always pointing to interesting articles from all kinds of sources, from the Journal of Climatology. And so I've developed sort of this curated list of people I follow, and when they see interesting things, Twitter can sound like it's just fluff and nonsense, and it's sort of what you make of it. It's how you put together who you follow. It can be rubbish, or it can be really interesting. And so that tunes me into a very diverse stream of news sources globally and across sectors, and has become a kind of radar for me of what's interesting out there. So it's pretty wide-ranging. It's not surprising what the base of it is, but these days, the sort of outreach, ganglia can reach in lots of directions, and we try and stay open because we try and bring in subjects from all over the info space.
It's not what you know, it's who told you so, right? There you go.
Yeah, what Clay says.
And that ends a conversation recorded November 9th on the campus of Iowa State University my colleague Clay Masters talking with Tom Ashbrook. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Also thanks to John Pemble for engineering today's show, as well as IPR's Amy O'Shaughnessy and Madeline King. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River, available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions. Contact us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.